Welcome back to Five Things with Lynn Hirschberg, featuring Aaron Sorkin. This is part two of the conversation. So tell me something in your life that you thought was a tragedy at the time or something that was unsettling at the time that turned out to be a positive thing. For instance, a job you didn't get, so you took another job, or a relationship that seemed like the center of your universe and then another relationship came along that was better, you know, because that relationship did not succeed, or something that had a...
Your examples aren't nearly as dark as what I was going to say.
And you can do lighter. I'm totally fine with that.
No, I was going to go darker.
Oh, go darker. Go darker. Yeah. I like darker.
I lost a decade of my life to freebase addiction, right? I lost my 30s. But, so how did that turn out to be a good thing? Because the recovery, and in 2 months, this April, I'll have 20 years.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
That struggle, and especially the first few years, it ain't easy.
I don't think it's ever easy.
And no, I don't think it is either. Makes you stronger. It makes you better. This is not to say that if I had a time machine, I would not go back to that moment when someone first taught me how to cook cocaine and not do it and changed my life significantly. But when I think about that, when I think about that time machine, I wonder, would altering that mean that I don't have my daughter, Roxanne? Mm-hmm. So bad, something I thought that was a bad thing that turned into a good thing. Anything that got me to my daughter, I consider a good thing.
Let me ask you something, because that's extremely beautiful. When you were doing extreme amounts of drugs, were you able to write?
Yeah, I was. I don't want to encourage anyone.
I understand.
I was what we call in the addiction community, the recovery community, a high-functioning addict, which is to say I didn't lose my job, my home, my family, my life savings, anything like that.
How about your health?
Obviously, my health deteriorated, but... People who talk about needing that first morning cup of coffee to wake up, crack me up. Because a cup of coffee will do nothing for me. My body is used to more high-powered narcotics.
Well, you know, I always stay at the Four Seasons. I'm here now at the Four Seasons.
And
I
always in L.A.?
In L.A., yeah.
Okay.
And I always think of you at the Four Seasons.
Well, I was holed up there. And, you know, my routine was...
Did you have a particular room? I'm curious. I always wonder that.
I did. 1401.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm in 1101. We're near each other.
I would call my dealer around sunset, who would, you know, bring over the coke. I would snort it so that I could stay all night writing. At around 5 a.m., this was when I was working on The American President, the movie. Around 5 a.m., I'd go down to the concierge, ask them to fax the pages that I'd done to Rob Reiner's office. He was the director of The American President. And he would call me and say, hey, these are terrific. You want to come into the office today? You just want to keep going? And I said, I'm just going to keep going. At that point, I would cook up the rest of the cocaine, smoke it for 24 hours. I never let anyone into the room. I think it was months before I let housekeeping into the room. So you're living a very dark life. You are lying all the time. Your only thought is about, you know, when can I hook up with my dealer and get straightened out? And eventually, what happened after about 10 years is I could kind of hear the footsteps behind me. People in my life plainly suspected something, and I felt like I was kind of days away from an intervention. So I checked myself into Hazelden, which is a wonderful rehab place. But before I did, I got a phone call from a woman I had never met or spoken to in my life. It was Carrie Fisher. Who called me at the request of Warren Beatty, in whose life I'd been for a while. And Carrie said, listen, I know you think you're not going to be able to write without Coke, but I promise you, you're going to write better. Now, she was right about both things. I didn't think I'd be able to write without cocaine. And when I went to Hazelden, I had no intention of quitting this stuff. My intention was to go away for 28 days, be a good patient, you know, not break any rules, behave myself, put 28 days between me and the last time I used. And when I come back, I'll have won everyone's trust back and I can go back to using. This 12-step thing isn't going to work on me. These fortune cookie slogans on the wall aren't going to work on me. And holy cow, frankly, it's the best medicine I've ever gotten. 28 days without medicine and a 12-step program and counselors who know what they're doing. Now, unfortunately, and this was, this was in 1995 that I went to Hazelden, and it was $15,000 then. So I don't know what it costs now, but it's sure not available to everyone. And this is more than you wanted to talk about rehab, I'm sure. But I remember on your 27th day of the 28 days there, they sit you down with someone who helps you make a health insurance claim to your insurance company and made the claim. And I just remember a few weeks later, I was home now and I opened my mail and there was a letter from Blue Cross Blue Shield saying that they didn't think my illness warranted treatment at the time. So they were denying my claim. And I thought, my God, how much blow are they doing at Blue Cross Blue Shield not to think that I warrant treatment? Anyway, my point is that places like Hazelden, and there are many fantastic rehab places, need to be available to everyone.
That's so fascinating. And that was it? You were done? Never had any moments where it came back to haunt you?
There have been many, many more than I can count moments where things got dangerous, where I could, there are triggers out there and you feel your body change. And it was years and years and years before I threw out my dealer's phone number. It was pinned to my wall. I was just too afraid to throw it out. And what I would do is, I knew that if I could just make it to 10 p.m., he doesn't deliver after then. So if I could make it to 10 p.m., not only would I be safe, but this feeling of, oh shit, I'm about to do it. I'm sorry about the language, would go away and I'd be able to go to sleep.
Wow. Have you ever been tempted to write about a drug addict, to do that as a main character?
I've never written about drug addiction. And as I was saying, I've thought about why haven't I ever written about this? It's a dark part of my life. It's the kind of thing that most writers would feast on. There was a while, and by the way, I came to drugs fairly late in life. I was 26 when I smoked weed for the first time.
Wow.
I guess the big reason, Lynn, it's not a personal reason. I guess the big reason is that I enjoy writing romantically and idealistically, and it doesn't quite fit in there. But the other reason it's hard is the reason why 12-step programs are so effective. It's because addict behavior is extremely predictable. In my unit at Hazelden, there was a farmer from Nebraska, and there was, frighteningly, an anesthesiologist from Boston.
Jesus.
And all of our crazy stories that would make a normal person go, oh my God, I can't believe you did something so crazy, sounds completely normal to the rest of us. And that's why when you go to rehab, every single person you come in contact with, from the nurse who checks you in to the person, you know, who puts lunch on your tray in the cafeteria to the head of the board of trustees, is a recovering addict. Okay? It's someone who gets it, who you don't have to explain yourself to. Anyway, you asked me why I haven't written about it yet. I don't know.
May I posit a theory?
Sure.
Well, I agree with your analysis. I think you have a very romantic personality and writing, and you want the world to be a certain way. Mm-hmm. And you create that world so beautifully. But I also think that you're not romantic about the drug addiction. And I think that no matter what happens in drug addiction movies, it somehow becomes romantic.
That's right.
That's a little bit of a problem.
You know what? I think you're making a really smart point, one that I've never thought of before and one that I've never heard of before. You're right about that. I have found nothing romantic about it.
Yeah. And no matter what you do, Drugstore Cowboy is weirdly romantic because they're attractive and they look good and cool.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing I love about you too. You're not so invested in what's cool. I've always loved that about your work.
A show like The Office, which I'm evangelical about The Office, it's very hard to be cool and have heart at the same time. And a show like The Office does that. I don't even make an attempt at cool. I wouldn't know how to do it.
Social network is cool. Social network is cool.
$1 billion is cool. that's what I meant by that first scene where I was trying to, how do I do college voices? And then screw it. You have no choice. You have to write like you. And I don't mean make people talk the way I talk, which is, I think, a frequent misunderstanding that I'm using characters as delivery systems for what I want to say. Cool is if it ever happened, it would happen by accident.
Well, I think you are cool, but I think it's not cool in the, you can't see me again, I'm doing quotes. You know, there's a kind of cool that people aspire to. I think you're cool because you're cool. You have authenticity and that's cool.
I don't think there's anyone from whom I'd rather get that compliment.
So tell me a purely joyous time in your life, like just as happy as you could be.
Okay, again, and it's a cliche, but my daughter being born and every day that came after that.
Oh, wow. Every day? Not even like there was...
Oh, come on. There are days, you know, as a parent, you say, my God. But especially since she is now a sophomore film major at NYU, which is a material breach of the deal I made with God when she was born. I'll just do a lot of good works and charitable giving if you will make sure that she's not anywhere near show business.
But you do realize you've made it very romantic.
By the way, I don't think, even though we're very close, she has always loved coming and visiting whatever set I was on. Like the West Wing set was like living in a dollhouse for her. She loved playing on that. I don't think that her love of filmmaking, which has been going on since her junior year of high school, she just writes short films and she makes them with her friends, which is exactly what she should be doing right now if she wants to pursue filmmaking. I don't think it has anything to do with me, Lynn. I think it has everything to do with Greta Gerwig. I think she saw Greta and saw a role model and saw that it's very hard to be what you can't see. So as soon as there was a female director that she could see, it starts to open the doors. And you saw what just happened this week with three women being nominated for Best Director in the Golden Globes. That, you could tell, it's for the last few years that was a wall that was about to come down. If you knock on that wall long enough and hard enough, it's going to come down. And it did. And now that there are people like Regina King, like Emerald Fennell, like Chloe Zhao, that people like my daughter can see, I don't think we're turning back to the time when studios were only comfortable with men in director's chairs.
What was the very first thing you directed? Was it a West Wing episode?
No. The very first thing I directed was Molly's Game.
No.
I never directed any episodes of the shows that I did because I thought there were people who could do it better, like Tommy Schlamme, and B, because I was writing all the episodes and couldn't there just wasn't time to do both.
And when you said you wanted to direct Molly's Game, what was going on in your brain? Were you scared to make that kind of leap?
What happened was I turned in the first draft of Molly's Game and then met the two producers for dinner, Amy Pascal and Mark Gordon. Amy had just left Sony, and I think this was the first film she was producing. And we had a list. I'm sorry?
And the second was Greta Gerwig.
And the second was Greta Gerwig, right. there was a list of a dozen or so directors, and we talked through each one. And at the end, the two of them, who plainly talked about this before, said, but we think you should direct it. And this was right before Christmas. And I was surprised to hear them say that. There was a moment when Amy and Scott actually thought I should direct The Social Network.
Oh, really?
And I was shocked to hear that. Mm. And the three of us said, I'll tell you what, before we make that official, let's send the script to David Fincher. And just when he passes, I'll direct it. And we sent it to him. And 3 hours later, I got an email from David saying, hey, Aaron, it's David. I'm going to direct The Social Network. Can I come over? I've never been so happy to not get a job.
Oh, really? You didn't even have a moment of disappointment?
No, not even a little bit. Uh-huh. I promise you. Not even a little bit. So I took the Christmas break to discuss, to consider Molly's Game. And should I direct Molly's Game? And I just knew with Molly's Game that there was a natural gravitational pull toward the shiny objects in Molly's Game, the money and the bold-faced names and the sexiness. And I didn't want a movie where the poster was like Jessica Chastain kicking her feet up and throwing chips in the air. It was just a different film that I was making. It was a more interesting film to make.
There was drugs in Molly's Game. It just came to me.
There were drugs in Molly's Game. We pass over it pretty quick.
You do.
But we make it clear that
it was bad.
She became addicted and then got herself into recovery.
Yeah.
So I decided on January 2nd, I came back to them. And Amy said, so what have you decided? And I started to say, I'll tell you, I'm leaning toward. And Amy said, no leaning toward. Say you're going to direct this film. And she scared me. And I said, okay. That's how it happened. I didn't know I was going to be the director of Chicago 7 when I wrote it.
You thought it was Steven Spielberg, right?
Oh, it was pretty much every member of the DGA before it was me. I went through a lot of very good directors. Again, I still haven't written a screenplay knowing that I was going to be a director. That's probably a good thing. If I had known I was going to be directing Molly's Game when I wrote it, I doubt I would have opened the film with like a terrible skiing accident during Olympic trials. Everything would have taken place in rooms. If I had known I was going to be directing Chicago 7 when I wrote it, I would have somehow tried to write it without showing the riots.
Yeah, that was tough. That must have been tough to do. But you know what? It turned out to be your timing was so brilliant. Sadly, your timing was brilliant.
Look, I always wanted the film to be about today and not 1968. None of us could have imagined how much about today it would end up being. We thought the film was plenty relevant last winter when we were making it. We didn't need it to get more relevant, but it did, obviously.
Even like January 6th?
January 6th, Donald Trump stood at a microphone and did exactly what the Chicago 7 were on trial for doing. And you know what else? That very conservative jury would have found him guilty because they were conservative. They weren't demented.
I mean, unbelievable. I have two questions and then I'll let you go, although I could talk to you all day.
The first is,
Sasha claims that he had to kind of convince you and, you know, he tried to convince Spielberg and then he started all over again, putting himself forward for Abby Hoffman for Chicago 7 with you. Is that in fact, how did he do that?
Okay. Steven cast Sasha 14 years ago. Okay. Steven cast Sasha. And when word kind of got out that this was starting up, and there have been so many in the last more than a decade moments when we thought we were making the movie. But when Sasha's people kind of heard the gears moving up, Sasha got in touch with me to let me know that the part is still his. I would not be casting anyone else in this part. So he didn't need to do a lot of convincing. I think he would have been anyone's first choice for the part.
He's magnificent. And the speeches you've written for him are beautiful. And two, do you keep a diary? You have such an amazing memory for this precise dates of things and the precise day. And do you just have that kind of mind, or do you keep an actual diary?
I don't keep a diary. I guess I just remember these things. There are other things. I assure you that I have a terrible memory for. There are things where I asked my assistant the other day how long I've been living in my house. Uh-huh. The answer was 12 years. Oh. But I could have just as easily guessed 5. there are things that I can't judge.
Do you know your daughter's age?
I do know my daughter's age, yes.
Do you know how long you lived at the Four Seasons? Because I want to know.
I lived at the Four Seasons. I had two residencies at the Four Seasons. Each of them lasted about a year and a half.
Wow. And it's not a big room. It's not that big a room.
It's not. And I didn't mind that at all. I didn't mind it not being a big room. I didn't mind anything about it. It's living at a Four Seasons is very easy. You dial two numbers and someone comes get your laundry. Dial another two numbers and someone brings you breakfast. It's, you never turn off the ignition on your car. You just get out of it. It's very easy. And after a while, I just thought this isn't, it's not very adult-like to live at a hotel unless your name's Warren Beatty.
Exactly. I was going to say you're like Warren, except you didn't pick the Beverly Wilshire.
I didn't pick the Beverly Wilshire. And, but I am now on, because I also, when I go to New York and I'm there a lot and sometimes for extended periods of time, like when we were making Chicago 7 or like when we were in rehearsal and previews for Mockingbird, I'm on some kind of Four Seasons list of people who have spent the most nights in a Four Seasons.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I'm very proud of that.
I'm impressed and jealous.
Yeah.
About 40
years. You ought to be jealous.
I am jealous.
How long is this residency of yours going to be at the Four Seasons? I don't want to get you attacked by anybody, but...
I'm going to be here probably about 50 days.
That would be impressive to most people.
I know. It's obviously not impressive to you. You shouldn't
to
say
most people it would be, though. I want you to know.
And I'm here with my dog.
They're very dog friendly.
She's like Eloise at the Plaza.
I'm sure she is.
I have one more question and then I'll let you go. But again, I really could talk to you all day. Okay. What have you missed most during quarantine, during pandemic time?
Okay, well, aside let me be very clear about something.
In person, of course.
The thing that every day troubles me the most about the pandemic is the economic crisis.
Yes.
Right? That I'll admit to being fairly well insulated from the problems of an economic crisis. However, people I work with and love are not. For instance, when Broadway and all theaters across America shut down on March 11th, not just our cast, but our crew and the ushers and the ticket takers and the people with my old job, bartenders, I don't know how they're surviving. I just don't. So before I talk about luxury items or high-minded items that I miss because of the pandemic, I just want to make clear that where my heart and thoughts are people who are just being clobbered by this once-in-a-century economic calamity. For instance, it's a silver lining to me. I mentioned that my daughter Roxy is in college, but she's home. She's, NYU is online. So that's nice for me. But what about the pizza places that near NYU that just count on the student population being there? They're done for. Okay, having said that, what I miss are audiences, okay? We were very, very lucky to have Netflix come along. This Chicago 7 was supposed to be released in theaters by Paramount. But Jim Giannopoulos, the head of Paramount, did market research last spring that showed us that the first people who were going to return to movie theaters were the people who think that the coronavirus is a hoax. Mm-hmm. And I agreed with Jim that we shouldn't have a lot of confidence that the Idaho militia is going to be showing up for the trial of Chicago 7. We were very lucky that Netflix came along. It was like having a lifeboat come along that had luxury cabins and a buffet. But I miss, there's a dynamic that an audience has, that shared experience when the lights go down, everybody laughing at the same thing, silent at the same thing, tearing up at the same thing, gasping at the same thing. I know it's very convenient to watch movies at home by yourself, but there is an audience component, that shared experience, that I'm clinging to the belief that once it's safe to go back to theaters, that people will miss that and no longer go back to theaters.
Thank you so much, Aaron. You were brilliant as always.
Lynn, I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Take care and thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Five Things with Lynn Hirschberg. Special thanks to the Four Seasons in Los Angeles. The podcast is produced by Michael Beckert. The audio engineers are Rich Cerbini and Max Solomon at Hangar Studios. The music is by Robin Shore. Thank you so much to Joy Feely, and thanks to Sarah Moonves for making Everything at W possible. Most of all, thank you to Zora.